Once upon a time, there was a dear little girl who was loved by everyone who looked at her, but most of all by her grandmother. There was nothing that she would not have given the child. Once she gave her a little red cap of velvet, which suited her so well that she would never wear anything else, and so she would always be called Little Red Cap. One day her mother said to her, "Come, Little Red Cap, here is a piece of cake and a bottle of wine. Take these to your grandmother. She is ill and she is weak, and these will do her good. Set out before it gets hot, and when you are going, walk nicely and quietly, and do not run off the path, or you may fall and break the bottle, and then your grandmother will get nothing. And when you get into her room, don't forget to say good morning, and don't peep into every corner before you do so." The grandmother lived out in a wood half a league away from the village, and just as Little Red Cap entered the wood, she was greeted by a wolf. Red Cap did not know what a wicked creature he was, and so she was not afraid of him at all. "Where do you go so early, Little Red Cap?" "To my grandmother's." "What do you have in your apron, Little Red Cap?" "I have some cake and wine. Yesterday was bacon day, so poor sick grandmother is to have something good to make her stronger." "And where does your grandmother live, Little Red Cap?" "A good quarter of a league further on in the wood. Her house stands under three large oak trees. The nut trees are just below. You surely must know it," replied Little Red Cap. And the wolf thought to himself, "What a tender young creature. What a nice plump mouthful. She'll be better to eat than the old woman. I must act craftily as to catch them both." So he walked for a short time by the side of Little Red Cap, and then he said, "See, Little Red Cap, how pretty the flowers are about here. Why do you not look around? I believe you do not hear how sweetly the birds sing. You walk so gravely as if you were going to school, while everything else here is so merry." Little Red Cap raised her eyes, and when she saw the sunbeams dancing here and through the trees, and pretty flowers growing everywhere, she thought, "Suppose I take grandmother some fresh flowers. That will please her too. It's so early on in the day that I shall still get there in good time." And so she ran from the path and into the wood to look for flowers. And whenever she had picked one, she fancied that there would still be a prettier one further on, and ran after it, and got deeper and deeper into the wood. Meanwhile, the wolf ran straight to the grandmother's house and knocked at the door. "Who is there?" "Little Red Cap," replied the wolf. "She is bringing cake and wine. Open the door." "Lift the latch," called out the grandmother. "I am too weak and I cannot get up." The wolf lifted the latch and the door flew open, and without saying a word, he went straight to grandmother's bed and devoured her. Then he put on her clothes. Dressed in her cap, he laid himself in her bed and drew the curtains. Little Red Cap, however, had been running around picking flowers, and when she gathered so many that she could not carry no more, she remembered her grandmother and set out on her way. She was surprised to find the cottage door standing open, and when she went into the room, she had such a strange feeling that she said to herself, "Oh dear, how uneasy I feel today, and other times I like being with grandmother so much." She called out, "Good morning," but received no answer. She went to the bed and drew back the curtains, and there lay her grandmother, with her cap pulled over her face, and looking very strange. "Oh, grandmother," she said, "what big ears you have." "The better to hear you with, my child," was the reply. "What large hands you have." "The better to hug you with." "But grandmother, what a terrible large mouth you have." "The better to eat you with." And scarcely had the wolf said this, that with one bound he was out of bed, and he swallowed Red Cap whole. When the wolf appeased his appetite, he lay down in the bed and fell asleep. He began to snore very loud. The hunter who was just passing the house thought to himself how the old woman was snoring very loudly. "I must see if she wants anything." So he went into the room, and when he came to the bed, he saw that the wolf was lying in it. "Do I find you here, old sinner?" said he. "I have long sought you." Then just as he was going to fire at it, it occurred to him that the wolf may have devoured the old grandmother, and she might still be saved, so he did not fire. He instead took a pair of scissors and began to cut open the stomach of the sleeping wolf. When he had made two snips, he saw a little red cap shining. And then he made two snips more, and a little girl sprang out crying. And after that, the aged grandmother came out alive also, but scarcely able to breathe. Red Cap, however, quickly fetched great stones in which they filled the wolf's belly. And when he awoke, he wanted to run away. But the stones filled his belly so heavy that he was unable. He fell down at once and fell dead. All three were delighted. The hunter drew off the wolf's skin and went home with it. The grandmother ate the cake and drank the wine which Red Cap brought her and was revived. But Red Cap thought to herself, "As long as I live, I will never by myself leave the path to run into the wood when my mother has forbidden me to do so." Red Cap was once again taking cakes to her grandmother. Another wolf spoke to her and tried to entice her from the path. Redcap, however, was on her guard and went straightforward on her way and told her grandmother that she had met the wolf and that he said good morning to her, but with such a wicked look in his eyes. If it had not been on a public road, she was certain he would have eaten her up. Well, we will shut the door so he may not come in. Soon afterwards, the wolf knocked on the door and cried, "Open the door, grandmother. I am Little Red Cap, fetching you some cake." But they did not speak, nor open the door. So the greybeard stole twice or thrice around the house. And lastly, he jumped on the roof, intending to wait until Red Cap was home in the evening, and then steal her away and devour her in the darkness. But the grandmother saw into his thoughts. In front of the house was a great stone trough. "I made some sausages yesterday. Take the water in which I boiled them to the trough." Redcap carried until the great trough was full. Then the smell of the sausages reached the wolf, and he sniffed and peeped down, and at last he stretched out his neck so far that he could no longer keep his foot in, and he began to slip. He slipped down from the roof and straight into the great trough, and drowned. But Redcap went joyously home, and never did anything to harm anyone. The story of Little Red Cap is one that I'm sure nearly everyone grown up has heard of, but it's likely the version you heard may have been called Little Red Riding Hood. At first glance, the story is a very simple tale that warns of the danger in talking to strangers and those who wish to trick and take advantage of you. But there are several interesting versions of the story. The first published version of the story was written by the French author Charles Perrault in the 17th century. In fact, much of Perrault's work would later be rewritten by the Brothers Grimm. Perrault's version centres around a young, well-bred village girl who is tricked by a wolf who lays a trap in her grandmother's house. He then, of course, eats the girl, but there is no woodcutter or hunter, and there certainly is no happy ending, as it is the wolf that emerges victorious in this story. Perrault's explanation of his story was that it was a warning to young, well-bred ladies to avoid listening to strangers, and many saw his version as an early warning of paedophilia. In the Brothers Grimm's version of the tale, it's very clear that the first story warns against the naivety and the trust of strangers. The second tale is almost the Brothers Grimm showing us what happens if you listen to the warnings of the first story and apply them to the same situation. This time you and Redcap can emerge the victor, rather than the victim. The story of Redcap, as I'm sure many of you are aware, has been adapted several times over the years, each time becoming more and more tame. So feel free to share any versions of the story that you may have heard with me in the comments below. As always, I've been your host, Mythology and Fiction Explained.
Greetings, everybody. This is Tabitha back for another edition of White Wellness. Today is October 30th, 2020, broadcasting out of New York for the American National Radio Network. That right there was a little reading of the grim fairy tale Little Red Cap, also known as Little Red Riding Hood, just one of the versions. Many grim stories have a couple of versions, and a lot of the Disney or the dismal movies actually were made from Grimm fairy tales. That would be Wilhelm and Jacob Grimm. You just wanted to play something a little kind of spooky and seasonal. This is kind of a spooky story, this Little Red Riding Hood tale. And there's a couple of other stories that have been sanitized out of the Grimm books that have to do with warning of terrible Jewish behavior and things like that. So maybe at one point I will orate one of those stories, which are a little bit harder to find. I doubt I'll be able to find a YouTube video of The Jew and the Thorns or one of the other, I think there's three they wrote that fit into that kind of that category. But anyway, just making the show a little bit of a seasonal opener right there with the grim version of Little Red Cap, more commonly known as Little Red Riding Hood. So for today's broadcast, I want to do something kind of a bit of a news show, but I guess kind of like a Halloween news show, I guess I would say is the best way to describe it. So let me get started with my notes and see what I have right here. Hello to everybody who's listening in the chat. Let's see what I have. Okay. So here's the first story that I found this morning. It has to do with Oyid AI. It says that Putin, or Jutin, which I think is more accurate, Putin mandates face masks as Russia combats the second wave of Oyid AI. So they, I guess, everyone has to wear the costume over in Russia. The article goes on to say Russia's public health agency also ordered bars and restaurants to close between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. for business to improve health protocols, whatever that means. And that, let's see, they're saying that they have the fourth most cases of the crown virus in the world in Russia. And of course, this means nothing. It doesn't mean that people are actually ill. Anyone can take one of those crown virus tests. I remember doing a broadcast a while back, and people were mailing in just tests that had, you know, no DNA on them at all, or putting like papaya DNA or juice on it and still getting, a false positive. So this thing is, it's so rigged. It almost seems more rigged than, the typhus deaths at the Red Cross, put forth as the real truth, during the Holocaust. This is just even seems like more of a lie. Not that that wasn't a huge lie, because of course it is, but this Oyed AI is just, it's like a snowball that keeps on traveling down a hill that gets larger and larger the more lies it is. Crazy. I remember thinking of this picture that I saw of Putin, I guess it was about a year ago, of his grandfather, and oh my God, he looked like a rat. So this guy, from what I can understand, definitely is an Oy Vey. People tend to think that Russia is like this this based place. I don't think that. Just like with Iran, no, neither of them are. So that was just some Oyed AI news that I found right there. It's always kind of a bunch of crud. And something else about France and Germany being thrust into a second Oyed AI wave, second lockdown rather, as Oyed AI wave sweeps Europe. So this could be something of a sign to come here. Who knows? So far, it seems like all the measures for Oyed AI have been way more draconian in Europe and New Zealand and Australia and Canada than they have been here in America. France begins a second nationwide lockdown today in an effort to stem a resurgence of the crown virus. The orders are less restrictive than a two-month lockdown from March to May, which happened prior. Schools will remain open, public fools, and residents will be allowed to buy groceries and visit the doctor, but otherwise required to stay home. Non-essential businesses, including bars and restaurants, will be closed through December 1. Similar restrictions are being put in place in Germany, while the United Kingdom introduced a tiered system 2 weeks ago that applies restrictions based on localized metrics. Mind-boggling. The situation appears equally grim in the U.S., which passed 9 million totally reported cases yesterday. Of course, that means nothing. New cases are being added at a pace of 75,000 per day, also means nothing, and an 80% increase since the beginning of the month. This is all just fear porn for people who still believe in Oyed AI. After weeks of holding steady whilst cases rose, they're saying new deaths are beginning to rise as well. The crisis is most acute in the Midwest and Wisconsin, they're telling us. Officials said ICU beds may run as little as 2 weeks. They're just prepping us for more of this as we go into the holiday season. That's the feel that I'm getting from this. They really want to up the fear porn. They want to make the holidays as dismal as possible. And now I'm seeing articles from places like JetBlue or JetJew, if you will. Everyone seems to be obsessed with air quality, especially on planes, right? And they're going on to say, oh, the air on the plane is, you know, just as healthy as the air in your house. Of course, that's not true. Cabin air can be very stale. It has to be recirculated. And this kind of plays off of this mysterious, invisible enemy that the virus is just, you know, wafting through the air out to get anybody. So I'm thinking that they're going to be fixing to promote the idea of, oh, the air has got to be clean, all this type of stuff, all this obsession with air quality, air filtration, all of this stuff. I'm even seeing this little thing I got from JetJew earlier today. Do you know that a recent study shows that the air inside our planes is typically as safe as the air inside your home or in a hospital operating room? Well, personally, I wouldn't want the air inside my home to have anything to do with the air inside of a plane or a hospital. And then they have their president and COO talking about this and the latest research. So I guess some people have been put off by flying because of Oyed AI, so they're trying to promote this. But this just leaves it open for a bunch of new industries to, I guess, pretty much come out, or for people to be making products like this for this whole new air industry of filtering the air. And this could definitely kind of lean over or blend into the whole climate change thing, saying like the air isn't clean. They could even go and say, oh, the virus is exacerbating climate change, right? This is why we have to get rid of all these farms, all of them, even the ones that are practicing regenerative agriculture, which of course is very holistic. It's a great thing. It's the reason why we're able to keep the environment in a good stead. So this whole obsession with air and the virus and Oyed AI, this could just be a catalyst for things like climate change and for pulling us back from our natural human diet, which includes meat, especially for the white race. I mean, where the hell would we be if we didn't have our ancestors eating meat? What did we get by on, especially in the cold north time, northern areas that many of our people are from or still from? How the hell could we have gotten by if we didn't have things like meat? We wouldn't have. But that's the feel that I'm getting that they're looking to go with, is this whole thing, this whole religion of health and safety and sanitization and hygiene. It's really obviously not those things. And the most mind-boggling thing about this is that these people who are obsessed with health and safety and hygiene, they're like the least racially hygienic people in the world, it seems like. But yeah, I can just see already that this is where they're going with this whole air thing. I'm even seeing an article right here. A room, a bar, and a classroom. How the crown virus is spread through the air. The risk of contagion is highest in indoor spaces. It can be reduced by applying all available measures to combat infection via aerosols. Oh, so spraying some really, really gross stuff in the air is going to help us. Here's an overview of the likelihood of infection in three everyday situations based on safety measures used and the length of exposure. And here they are doing some trials of people hanging out in a living room, just like normal socializing in a living room. Really, really crazy. This is all transhumanism. If you need any more evidence than that, it's so obvious. And here they show like droplets of coming out of someone's nose and mouth and how 12,000 aerosols are released in every droplet. And people who are buying into this religion, I mean, they're probably still sheltering in place, breathing, speaking, and shouting. Another way that they can kind of get us to not talk is the whole virus thing of it spreading, spreading stuff, which of course is an absolute hoax. I saw a story that was happening, I think, somewhere in the UK, where they weren't going to be playing music in pubs and bars and restaurants because then people were going to have to talk at a higher volume, and then that could be spreading the crown virus. And of course, it's not contagious. This is not a virus. This is one of the biggest hoaxes ever. But this sick article, that's kiked out scientism article, goes on and on talking about showing someone speaking, showing someone shouting, and how many particles were emitted. It's just mind-boggling. Think of another situation of a bar, people in a bar, the first one being a living room, and how they could get Oyed AI. And this can infiltrate and affect every single aspect of everyone's life. And the final simulation is a classroom with students and a teacher. So of course, always about health and safety and all that stuff with, let's save children, all that crap. It's obviously just a hoax, just an obvious hoax. No, Josh. Josh just sent me something. Let me see. Am I, you're live casting on the Brow Finished Live. Am I still coming in, by the way? Is my sound coming in? If anyone in the chat can just tell me. Let's see. Josh just sent me a message. I'll write him back. Okay. Maybe I guess I'm still coming in clear. Okay. It looks like I am. You're live casting in another browser. Finish live. Okay. I think I'm still coming in. If anyone can tell me in the chat if I'm still coming in live, just let me know. OG Snake Eyes is saying, yes, Putin has Jewish ancestry. And in the UK, they're talking about arresting people in their houses for celebrating Christmas if there's too many people. Yowza. That is mind-boggling. I can't say I'm surprised, though. I just really can't. That's crazy. But we can't be surprised with all the crap that's going around. I mean, who would have thought, like, if someone would have told you, like, a year ago, now, that you could be arrested for celebrating, Christmas or Yule in your house with friends and family, I don't think they would believe you. But now, based on what we've had this year, wow, crazy. Okay, on to the next topic, but something I'm just, the whole thing about air and air quality and the Oyves being obsessed with it, I think that's something to look for or just to keep an eye out on. All right, what else do I have here? Let's see, a couple of stories for the broadcast. Let's see. I didn't make the best notes before, but I think I have somewhat of a semblance of notes. Let's see. Okay. All right. I think I will go to some of the paper notes that I have, some of the paper clippings that I have for the broadcast. All right. So one thing that I wanted to mention, and this is actually kind of goes back to what I mentioned when I was doing that show with Molly, the last show that we did together. We mentioned, or she mentioned, The Invisible Rainbow, a book that was written by Arthur Furstenberg, which I believe is an Oyve. But nevertheless, this seems like an interesting book. I do not have this book. It's called, the full title is The Invisible Rainbow, A History of Electricity and Life. So just wanted to read this little review about this book in case anybody who's interested in 5G, energy, all of this stuff would probably like to know more about it. Here's just a bit about it right here. Arthur Furstenberg is a scientist and journalist who was at the forefront of the global movement to tear down the taboo surrounding the subject of electromagnetic radiation. He has done a tremendous amount of history research on the invention, experiments, and implementation of electricity in all forms, from the 18th century to the present 21st century. From early telegraph to radar, computers, cell phones, wireless devices, and orbiting, quote, 5G satellites. The Invisible Rainbow is a 392-page book plus 172 pages devoted to notes, bibliography, and index. It seemed as if almost every paragraph was documented with research on how electricity affects all forms of life, flora, fauna, and humanity. So everyone, from animals to us to all the plants. Although society has so far chosen to remain blind to the facts, and of course there's been a lot of agendas to keep us blind, not all of us are blind, the book provokes an awakening to the realities of the effects of electricity, radio waves, and electromagnetic radiation. Furstenberg has correlated the historical appearances of influenza or influenza epidemics with each new implementation of electricity and radio waves. Separate chapters on diabetes, cancer, chronic and acute electrical illness, and other illnesses are correlated with man-made electrical disturbances and ionizing radiation. In the modern era, the proliferation of mobile phones, towers, and antennas beginning in 1996 are equated with health statistics that leave no doubt about the correlation. Okay, next. Next chapter, the author plainly states that there is much we don't understand about the effects of our human interference with the ionosphere, biosphere, and magnetosphere surrounded and energizing the Earth. He quotes a prominent current physicist regarding our interference as, quote, an irresponsible act of global vandalism. An 18th century professor of physics warning that, quote, harnessing electricity is tampering with life. In addressing the immediacy of the global situation, the author states the global electrical circuit provides the energy for all living things. It is why we are alive, and it is the source of all health and healing. All doctors of Oriental medicine know this, except they call it qi or chi. It flows from the sky to the earth, and it circulates through our meridians and gives us life. It is electricity, and this is what we'd also call in the Vedic traditions prana, in the Nordic ones, vril. It's all the same thing. It's just energy. You cannot contaminate the global electrical circuit with millions of pulsed, modulated electronic signals without destroying all life. It's a compromise, essentially. We are living in a world where information does not increase knowledge nor open eyes. The cultural barriers are too great, and I would say the Oive propaganda is too great. Society has been in denial for too long, and yet it is impossible to continue on the present path any longer. Decisions are being made to intensify the global microwave rain before 2020 from a steady drizzle to a downpour. Mr. Furstenberg summarizes that the promise of the ubiquitous wireless technology they call 5G or 5G, enabling the creation of the Internet of Things and wireless connectivity of virtually everything, will likely require as many as 1 trillion antennas talking to one another and outnumbering people on Earth by 100 to 1. He states that, quote, that promise, however, is the ultimate Trojan horse, containing with it an unprecedented threat, the annihilation of severe impoverished, severe impoverishment of life itself. Unsuspected, that is, by those who could not see what is happening. This book is engaging, extremely informative, and a valuable asset to anyone interested in our history of humanity, electricity, and our environment. It is destined to be a classic. So yeah, pretty interesting stuff right there. If anyone's interested in further exploring the relationship between, you know, electricity and electromagnetic radiation and 5G and dis-ease, this would be a good place to start, would be that book. And of course, they've tried to downplay any of those angles ever since, you know, the Oyin AI situation. But like I said in the broadcast, I guess it was more than a couple of months back when I talked about the Spanish Jew or the Spanish flu of 1918, that had a definite correlation with more electromagnetic radiation in the, in the environment. And everyone got ill from that because of the electromagnetic radiation and also because of vaccination. And people who were sick even did experiments where they would spit somewhere, I think in the mouth or something like that, pretty gross stuff, on somebody who was healthy to try to, quote, infect them with their contagious disease. It didn't work. It just boggles my mind how the germ theory or the Joom theory, which Pasteur on his deathbed recanted, how people can still believe this, like, dark age medieval type of bullshit. It's really zoggling. It makes me think of that theory that was around, I think it was in the 1700s, the miasma theory, the theory that bad smells could have you be sick. Imagine that. I mean, that really sounds like a religion. That sounds like more of a religion than Oyin AI, but the miasma theory is pretty much the same as the germ or the Joom theory, the idea that this evil spirit in the air is going to get you sick. I mean, it's such an Abrahamic, Talmudic belief system. It's really mind-boggling. I just want to check if I'm coming through in the chat because no one has written back, so I'm not sure if I am, if I've lost my connection. Of course, I'm doing a double recording on my my Audacity, but let me just check. Oh, it looks like I'm coming in live. Let me just check right here. Oh, great. You guys can hear me. Okay, now I'm getting an echo. Okay, I'm just going to sign out of this. Yeah, for some reason, I go in my phone and I can see I'm coming in live, but then if I'm here in the studio on my computer, all I can see is the last thing I can see is a message from OG Snake Eyes about the Jew K. That's the only thing I can see. And I wonder if I refresh the page, if I will lose the broadcast. Maybe there's a way that I can mute it, because I'm going to hear my own voice if I'm talking and I'm trying to look at the chat on my phone. Pretty weird. I don't know what's really going on there. All right. Anyway, I just wanted to share that little piece about 5G. I think it's important, very important information that we know this type of stuff about how dis-ease isn't necessarily the way that we think it is. I mean, we've all grown up and been somewhat conditioned to think certain things, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. Just because we were brought up to believe something doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. Okay, onward with some more stuff now. Let's see what I've got. Okay, I've got some more interesting stuff. Some of this corresponds to Oyed AI, and some of this just corresponds to just keeping good health. So this little bit that I have right here, this comes from the Weston A. Price Foundation quarterly magazine called Wise Traditions. I have a subscription to this. Every quarter, like every season, they send out this magazine. I think it's a very good magazine. If anyone's ever looking for material to read, I don't necessarily agree with 100% of the information in here, but nevertheless, I think it's a very good publication. I enjoy looking over this publication, you know, during breakfast and lunch and things like that. And it's easy for it to stay open while you're reading it, which is another plus. But anyway, here are some things in this quarterly this month. And there's a lot of very good information in here about Oyed AI, because a book just came out, The Contagion Myth, written by Sally Fallon Morell, as well as Dr. Thomas Cowan, talking about all about terrain theory and all about the myth of contagion. So anyway, just wanted to go over a couple of stories in the section called Caustic Commentary in the WPAF Quarterly. And this is all written by Sally Fallon Morell, who is the editor and I believe the founder of the Weston A. Price Foundation, which was founded back in 1999. And they do some pretty good research. I like I said, a lot of the stuff they have to say. So here's a little bit about germs and genes. I have often pointed out that modern medicine likes to blame the three G's for dis-ease: germs, genes, and God. A perfect example of this misplaced castigation is evident in the August 10th issue of the Examiner article, "What Really Killed Elvis?" which claims that it wasn't long-term drug use or a poor diet that killed Elvis off at the age of 42, but bad genes. And this is a mind-boggling thing, this notion of bad genes. We see this a lot in the allopathic or the Western medical system. Whenever you go to a doctor, they always like to ask you to, like, who in your family died of, you know, what supposed genetic disease. Of course, there's a field called epigenetics. I think the doctor is Dr. Bruce Lipton. So just because someone in your family had something, some ailment, maybe they even died from it, right? It doesn't mean that you're destined for that path, but the allopathic system puts so much fear into people via bad genes that they want you to think that. And of course, the only solution is their, quote, treatment. Elvis was doomed to die young, says Dr. Stephen Kingsmore, a specialist in, quote, genomic medicine, who analyzed a sample of Elvis's hair. The conditions Elvis suffered from, obesity, heart dis-ease, irregular heartbeat, high blood pressure, and bad eyesight, were inherited, the doctor says. Mind-boggling, right? Elvis also suffered from fatigue and fainting. This has nothing to do with his diet, says Kingsmore, which included something called Fool's Gold Loaf, a hollowed-out loaf of bread stuffed with peanut butter, an entire jar of grape jam, and a pound of bacon slathered with margarine and then deep-fried, nor the fact that toxicology reports found 11 drugs in the singer's system. There had been so much speculation about the cause of death, says Kingsmore, and so much ill spoken of his lifestyle, and we had this intriguing finding that possibly Elvis had a medical illness, and all of the stuff about how he killed himself with his lifestyle might have been very unfair. Wow, that's exactly what the allopathic medical modality would like you to believe. Even if you spend, you know, a good majority of your life and you start just doing terrible stuff to yourself, utilizing lots of drugs, you know, eating a terrible diet. No, it wasn't any of that stuff. It was bad genes. Now, how ridiculous does that sound? It really sounds ridiculous. Really ridiculous. And it's, of course, it's not true. It's only true in regards to the allopathic modality. And it's just crazy to me that doctors don't really take anything into account of, like, what somebody eats. Like, if someone has an ailment and they go to the doctor and they say, oh, if I do this, will things get better for me? Oh, no, you don't. Changing your diet won't help you at all. Like, imagine, like, someone goes to, like, a gastroenterologist and they're having, like, a lot of digestive stuff, and the doctor's like, yeah, there's nothing you can do with your diet to help yourself. There's no dietary change. I mean, fuck this system. Who needs to hear shit like that to be gaslit by a bunch of kiked out MK Ultra psychopaths? Fuck them. Okay, the next story. So that was just a little bit about germs and genes. And I like to remember that mantra. People always blame the three G's for dis-ease: germs, genes, and God. Because when you do that, you relieve yourself of any responsibility, right? You're not taking any responsibility when you say, oh, it was this, it was this, it was this. Like with the virus crisis, right? Oh, I'm not taking any responsibility for my health. The virus got me, right? What a load of crap. It's so Abrahamic. So now something else, something about glyphosate. And glyphosate, of course, is this herbicide, which they use in Roundup, which is a Monsanto product. And this gets into our food supply. And this is very, very terrible for our endocrine or our hormone system. Very, very bad. This is just one of the reasons why we see so many people, especially so many youngsters who are just dealing with estrogen dominance. We see a lot of boys that are very, you know, feminized. This is really, really bad. And this glyphosate stuff is in a lot of foods, a lot. So here is a little article about glyphosate and how it affects the endocrine system. This is very important stuff. And this little tidbit focuses mostly on female health, female reproductive health and fertility. But this is for everybody. This is just a little tidbit that I have, and they're giving an example of how this affects childbearing women. But this is information for every single person, male or female, no matter how old you are. Evidence of glyphosate toxicity continues to accumulate. Glyphosate is a herbicide in Roundup and other products that it is mostly that is most used worldwide, especially on corn, soybean, and lawns. And wheat would be another thing that is sprayed with glyphosate. And even if you're using wheat in a fermented sense, like if you're having a beer and it's just like a regular, you know, Budweiser, whatever, Coors, that's going to be made with fermented GMO grain, and the fermentation is not able to alter the glyphosate. Many reported adverse effects are due to exposure at high doses. I wouldn't even want to have a small dose of this stuff. However, a recent study indicated that low dose exposure alters the development of the female reproductive tract, with consequences on fertility. So how would this factor in if somebody was consuming a glyphosate-laden diet while they were pregnant? Think about that. Studies have demonstrated that exposure to glyphosate alters the development and differentiation of ovarian follicles and the uterus, affecting fertility when animals are exposed before puberty and during gestation. The main mechanism for these frightening effects is the modulation of estrogen receptors and molecules involved in estrogenic pathways. And that comes from the Molecular and Cellular Endocrinology Journal, I guess, from July 10. But very, very important information right there. And not only does this affect the endocrine or the hormonal system, this will also affect the gut biome. And of course, the hormones, the metabolism, and the gut, they're all working together. So if one of those things is messed up for you, chances are one of the other ones could be messed up for you too. And when someone eats something that has glyphosate in it, that could really, really mess up and compromise their microbiome. And then they could have issues with, you know, digestive stuff, going to the bathroom, etc. So it's really behoove us to basically eliminate that, or to limit it into our diet as much as we can, or just to kind of stay away from foods, especially foods that you know are going to be sprayed with this. If you want to have corn or wheat, definitely get yourself something organic. The soy, for the most part, I would say is probably a good move to not include in your diet. It's just not really a good thing to be having. It's just, especially, it's really not part of like our original diet. I mean, you could say that it's part of the Asian diet, you know, Japanese, like East Asian, North Asian, like Japanese and Chinese and Korean, but they use a much smaller quantity. They're not eating like a huge slab of tofu. And they eat most of it fermented. And I don't even know if it's really the best thing for them, because from what I can understand, I believe that Japan has higher rates of Hashimoto's, which is a thyroid disease. And it makes sense that I think that that word was possibly originated in Japan, because Hashimoto is a Japanese sounding word. So even if a food is traditional, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's healthy, right? Like even when I was talking about in one of my prior broadcasts, just because a fermented food is traditional, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's healthy or it's going to work for you. You got to find what works for you. But nevertheless, avoidance of glyphosate would be a very smooth move. And I don't think it's necessarily that difficult. Maybe it takes a bit of planning if you're eating outside of the house. But I think now more than ever, especially with Oyate AI, we should really be eating inside of the house more than ever. It just makes sense. Let me just check the chat. I'm going to check it from my phone right here, see if any messages come up. Okay, I just heard that echo. I guess the echo is gone. I'm just not going to be checking the chat anymore because then I'm going to get like that weird echo. So, okay. So just a little information there on glyphosate, but I think it's pretty important information. Okay, something else that has to do somewhat with Oyate AI, but also just with health. And this has to do with vitamin A and the lungs. And I've always made the differentiation on the broadcast that vitamin A is retinol. It comes from animal foods like liver. The stuff that is in, you know, squash and sweet potatoes and carrots, that's not true vitamin A. That's beta carotene. It doesn't convert well for a lot of people. So we can't really say that we're getting vitamin A from those foods, those orange foods. Although those foods are good, there's a lot of good for them, they're not a source of vitamin A. But vitamin A deficiency is the most common nutritional disorder in the world. And unfortunately, what they do, a lot of these organizations, is they go and they give children synthetic vitamin A, which they're saying will help with the malnutrition, but it doesn't. Synthetic vitamin A is actually rather toxic. So here's a bit about vitamin A and the lungs. And most people are not getting enough vitamin A, whether they're living here in the States or in a, you know, a less impoverished place. And a lot of these places where these youngsters are experiencing malnutrition, it's because they're not eating a traditional foods diet anymore. They're eating a diet. Vitamin A deficiency constitutes, with protein malnutrition, another huge problem in a lot of the, you know, third world, the most common nutritional disorder in the world. So states a review article, Vitamin A Deficiency in the Lung, published in the journal Nutrients in September, 2 years ago. The authors noted that vitamin A is the most multifunctional vitamin in the human body, as it is involved in several essential physiological processes from embryogenesis to adulthood. These include vision, immunity, cell differentiation and proliferation, embryological development, and antioxidant function. Recent research indicates a role in vitamin A related to insulin function, lipid metabolism, energy balance, and redox signaling. So wouldn't it think that if someone was low in vitamin A, maybe they would be more predisposed to diabetes, hypoglycemia, things like that, if they were having improper insulin function and improper lipid metabolism, and also be more prone to weight issues and all that stuff. As for the lungs, vitamin A is involved in the proliferation and maintenance of epithelial cells, including those of the respiratory tract, and is a major factor regulating differentiation and the maturation of the lung. Vitamin A deficiency leads to negative historic changes within the respiratory tract and indicates that retinoids continue to play an important role in the adulthood lung. Thus, adequate vitamin A intake would be especially important for protection against what they're saying, the lung disease called Oyate AI. And I wouldn't say that Oyate AI is a lung disease. I would say that Oyate AI is basically being microwaved. That's what it appears to be for me. And a lot of people have a lot of metals and junk like that in their system from vaccination, from pharmaceuticals, from low quality water, from iron fortified foods, from the wrong supplements, illicit drug use, as well as OTC drug use, as well as, like I said, judicial pharma, usage. Plus, when you mix that toxicity with an exceedingly malnutritious diet, a multi-generational malnutritious diet, then you get what they're calling Oyate AI. That's the way it works. That's at least how I'm seeing it. But nevertheless, regardless of all of this Oyate AI crud, it's very important that people get vitamin A in their diet. And it really has to come from an animal source. definitely has to come from an animal source. Vitamin A, animal foods. Here we go. So eggs and meat and cheese and cream. They're saying fortified milk. Please, nobody out there eat any fortified foods. Don't do that. They're fortified with all types of very gnarly synthetic vitamins. If you want to get vitamins, eat food that contains vitamins. It's pretty simple. I actually heard something a while ago. I think when the supplement industry first kind of started, which was about 100 years ago, that whenever they would kind of pull back a food in the diet, I'm talking here in America, you would see that supplement or that vitamin or that mineral hit the market as like the new hot thing people are supposed to be taking. When they were taking that food, the natural source, because nature always puts all the stuff together in the package called food, as opposed to isolating it, which isn't a healthy way to take something. It's very Talmudic. So once they took that food out of the diet that included all those vitamins and minerals, then they unleash this supplement that supposedly is going to help us. See, this is how they always work. It's extremely sneaky. So vitamin A comes from animal foods. Other things, like I said, the orange foods, you really can't guarantee that you're going to be getting vitamin A from these foods. Most people can't convert it. I would bet that the majority of white people with northern ancestry would have the hardest time converting the vitamin A in the plant foods to a good source of retinol, because I really can't. So you really want to get this from animal foods, from beef liver, lamb liver, liver sausage. Mackerel is one of the foods, but then again, that's pretty high in HUFAs, so I might not recommend, and also mercury, so I might not recommend mackerel. Goose liver. Goose liver is a very good source of vitamin A, also an excellent source of vitamin K2. A goat cheese, butter, Limburger cheese, that stinky cheese, cheddar, camembert, roquefort, hard-boiled egg, trout, blue cheese, caviar, feta cheese, cream cheese. You guys get the idea. This has vitamin A. And if you really want to get the biggest punch, like daily amount for your value, liver. Liver is the best thing. Like the daily value of vitamin A, you get over 700% of your daily value in vitamin A for one serving of beef liver. And they're saying it's one slice. And they're saying if you're taking lamb liver, which of course has a softer taste, just like calves liver does, 1 ounce of lamb liver will give you 236% of your vitamin A requirements. And all the RDAs that they have telling you need this amount of this, this amount of this, those were originally developed, what I could understand, for the prison population, just to keep people alive at a bare minimum, just 10% of the values, just enough to keep people alive, but not enough to keep people thriving. And many tribes and native and primitive people would eat like 10 times what the RDAs are for certain things. And the OIVs always like to scare us with vitamin A being terrible for us. They like to freak us out, especially they like to do this to women who are pregnant. And all the studies they've done have been on synthetic vitamin A, not on whole foods vitamin A from something like, you know, liver, which a lot of our ancestors were eating. Like I've talked to some older folks, like boomers and people older than that, and many of these people would have liver like once a week, once a month, and maybe they didn't like it, but they were healthier for it, right? And I think oftentimes, like, you may not like a taste of something because you've been conditioned to like different things, right? Like I've heard stories of the people bringing like pizza over to like some tribes and them being disgusted by the way it looks and not wanting to try it. But here we go bonkos for pizza. So it all really depends like what you've been conditioned to eat, like Eskimo children going wild for high meat, right? They wouldn't go wild for pizza. So just something to think about right there. And I think it's very important to get enough vitamin A in the diet. I would say that probably most people are deficient in vitamin A, and you have to be able to have enough of this vitamin A in your system in order to absorb vitamin D from the sun. It's very easy for us being white, having less melanin, to absorb enough vitamin D from the sun. We don't need that much time outside in order to do so. Okay, let me just take a wee look at the chat. I hope that echo doesn't happen again. Maybe I can just, turn the sound off on my phone or something. Let me try that. Let me just totally see if I can just mute all the sound on my phone and see if it comes in now. Okay.
Okay.
All right, so no new comments. Just wanted to check up on there if anyone had a comment. All right, so just a little bit right there about vitamin A, but I think it's important to stress it because I think it's a pretty important thing to have in our diet. All right, on to some other topics now. Let me just go back to my notes right here, see what else I have going on. We talked about the European lockdowns happening in France as well as Germany, right? We did talk about that. What else do I have? There's so much going on, and most of it is absolute crud, apparently. Of course, everyone knows that. I did see some stuff on Twitter this morning. This is one of the top stories on Twitter. Walmart removes guns and ammunition from store floors amid civil unrest. The retailer said the decision was prompted by protests and looting in Philadelphia, as Mike calls it, I think that's hysterical, sparked by the police killing of Walter Wallace Jr., a black man with mental health issues who approached them whilst carrying a knife. Whilst guns and ammo won't be stocked on the shelves, they will still be available for sale. Okay, so basically they're removing it from the store floors, but they're still going to be having the ammo in the store. And I don't know too much about this Walter Wallace case, but if a person is approaching you while carrying a knife, how are you supposed to know if that person has, quote, mental health issues, right? I mean, is everyone given like a dossier on a criminal before the criminal approaches them? And of course, it looks like the Jewish media is going to run with this story. I don't know what race the cop was, but it looks like they're trying to make this into like another George Floyd, making it look like maybe like some, you know, some white supremacist cop like killed some black guy who was, you know, had a mental problem. Kind of like the same thing they're doing with the Trump-Biden dialectic. Like here's this meanie Trump and he's just picking on this guy that's got mental issues, right? Or, you know, has Alzheimer's. So I'm not going to go too much into this because I don't know too much about it. But then again, it was a Walmart that was burned down to the ground, too, right? Or burned down, if it burned down to the ground. But Walmart was burned by these protesters. So just more of this Zog stuff. And has anyone ever noticed that Walmart star that looks like it's got like a sun ray of like six rays? Doesn't it look like the Jew star from World War II that they were wearing on themselves? That's what it looks like. It's probably some type of predictive programming. Of course, that's our symbol, the Anahata, the six-pointed star representing the sacred relationship of male and female, Shiva and Shakti. But the Oyves have appropriated that symbol for themselves. And for them, they don't care about the sacred relationship of men and women. All they care about is toxic masculinity and the dark feminine. That's the Oyves in a nutshell. Of course, they are always going on about everyone else's toxic masculinity. They themselves, the race, really don't have a lot of masculinity. Their men are kind of like dark feminine creatures in a way. It's weird, especially when they get that terrible thing happen to them, the circumcision on the eighth day. That's an awful procedure in general. It's like a rape, razor rape. It's an awful thing in general, but when you do it at that time, it's even worse. It's probably like a transsexualizing, transhumanizing type of thing. I mean, it's weird. Sometimes we think we've been like not living in transhumanism for a long time. We're like, oh, all this stuff is just new in the last couple of years. We've been living with transhumanism for a long time. I would even venture to say that whenever these Oyve desert sand fairy religions first started out, that was the beginning of transhumanism. Look at all the altering they do to themselves, right? They have to wear this parasite cap over their talu chakra, right? They have to cut part of their body off to have a closer relationship with the sand fairy. This is all transhumanism. This is all physical engineering and social engineering. We've been living in transhumanism for like 2,000 plus years. It's just more evident now with more of the technological aspects of it. But I think transhumanism or transhumanism can definitely be a pre-existing factor, not in the high-tech way that we know it nowadays, even though I'm rather certain that there's way more tech out there than they let on. Like, I was watching this video of Germany like 100 years ago, and it showed some of the trains and the rails that they had there, and it really looked like it was very, very far advanced. And now look at the things we have. I mean, are we really that advanced? It really seems like we could have been way more advanced if we had taken things in a different direction. But when the claw of the enemy gets itself enmeshed with technology, we have all these dastardly things like Oyid AI. That's why I've been calling it Oyid AI, because it really is the final consolidation of the JWO, which is AI, which is contact tracing, which is reducing us all to the smallest common denominator or totally annihilating us. That's why I believe it to be Oyid AI. I think it's a very succinct way of summing it up. And of course, we know who is behind it. It's the Yids. It's obvious. So just a little bit there about transhumanism, and I see that Walmart story right there. I don't frequent a Walmart. We don't have too many of them over here on Oyvay Island. I've only been maybe a couple of times to it. One of the only big box stores that I'll go to is Costco, and that's not even too often, but I do get a couple of things there. But in general, I'm not really much of a big box store shopper. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about transhumanism and Walmart and all that type of stuff. Ugh, gross. I'm just seeing right here on Twitter that it looks like, I don't really know where this is in the world, but someone posted some mural of Ruth Bader, or Ruth Bagel Ginsburg, as Mike calls her. It almost reminds me of those George Floyd murals. Gross. It's really wild who they venerate, you know, as an Oyvay saint. It's always these really just unsavory, surly, repugnant, quote, humans. Okay, on to the next topic for the broadcast. I'm just skimming this email that I got that I get some of the good stories for the broadcast from here, so I'm just taking a gander to see if there's anything here that is useful for the broadcast. I think I've talked about most of these things. It says here that 2.6 million people are without power after Hurricane Zeta speeds across the southeastern U.S. and 5 are killed. Terrible. So many things going on right now. We have, you know, Oyid AI, the selection, the primate proxy, the hurricane. It's a very, very chaotic time, but hopefully within the confines of that chaos, we will have more of our people awakening, becoming racial, and coming over to our side. That is my hope. All right, it doesn't look like there's much here in this email. There's actually a little bit about Halloween, some Halloween stuff. Maybe I'll go over this just to keep the broadcast slightly seasonal, even though I did a seasonal broadcast yesterday with Mike, and that was a great show. We had a lot of fun just talking about a lot of different and very interesting topics. So if you haven't caught that one yet, please catch that broadcast. So let's see, a brief history of the Halloween costume. This could be an interesting article. It comes out of Communist News Network, so I don't know how interesting of an article this is going to be, but anyway. From Pagan Spirits to Wonder Woman, a brief history of the Halloween costume. And here it shows some youngsters back in Cincinnati, Ohio, 1929. That was the year of the Oyvay stock market crash. And gosh, these costumes are terribly spooky. Looks like one of the youngsters is dressed up as a gypsy, and the other two are wearing these very creepy masks. One's a clown, and one just looks like a really weird-looking person. Weird. It looks like a cross between like an Asian and a bird. A very unusual costume. Halloween costumes from the first half of the 20th century were terrifying. Drawing on the history's pagan and Christian roots as a night to ward off evil spirits or reconcile with death, respectively, people often opted for the morbid, serious costumes than the pop culture ones inspired today. And there is a bit of a Abrahamic onlay within the confines of Samhain or Halloween. Of course, like we had talked about yesterday on the broadcast, this is a pagan holiday, this is a white holiday, but since many of our people have Christian roots, they kind of blended that into their Halloween festivities. I'm just seeing some more of people's costumes throughout the years. These are all old school costumes. It says, the genesis of Halloween costumes may date back to over 2,000 years ago, so way before any of those desert sand fairy religions. Historians consider the Celtic pagan festival of Samhain, which marked summer's end and the beginning of the year's, quote, darker half in the British Isles, to be the holiday's precursor. So that's so cool. How much is that like our people to basically make a holiday based on the ebb and flow of nature? How Aryan is that, right? As opposed to the Uyghurs, where they have some holiday because they trick somebody and they killed them, right? Disgusting. Okay, here's something else. In the 1960s, the costumes became lighter and more playful. Here they're showing a masked guest with a pumpkin that was captured at a fancy dress Halloween party. So things got a little different as time went on, a little less spooky, but it looks like the Halloween costumes were like 100 plus years ago. Gosh, these are terrifying, some of these costumes. This one looks like a Klansman right here, this costume. That's kind of funny. And the pumpkin looks to be black. Maybe that's some fun stuff right there. Let's see. Wow, looks like a really spooky looking mummy. People really got down with the spooky costumes back in the day. That's weird, because it's really not so much a spooky holiday like we had said yesterday on the broadcast. It's really more of a time with the ancestors, but some of this Christian stuff, this Abrahamic miasma, if you will, could have crept on to us. And our traditions, even though this is really just about the seasons. And what's Yule or Christmas about? The same thing. It's about the literal death of the sun, not S-O-N, but S-U-N. And it's about going into that time of year when there is less light, when we do spend, you know, less time doing stuff, where the energy becomes more of a hibernation type of thing. Anything else in this article that I could read? Oh yeah, this is actually some pretty interesting stuff. Let's talk about the ancient roots of Halloween. I will do a Christmas show, or we'll all do a Christmas show at some point. So here we go. It was believed that during the festival, and that is Halloween, the world of the gods became visible to humans, resulting in supernatural mischief. Some people offered treats and foods to the gods, whilst others wore disguises such as animal skins and heads, so that wandering spirits might mistake them for one of their own. That's kind of like the original Halloween costume, if you will. Hiding behind their costumes, villagers often played pranks on one another, but blamed the spirits. Masks and cover-ups came to be seen as means to get away with things. That's continued throughout Halloween's evolution. Well, think about that line right there. Masks and cover-ups came to be seen as a way to get away with things. We've seen that this year, haven't we, with the primate proxy, with BLM, just in general, with the Oyves masking their appearance, being cryptic, engaging in crypsis via plastic surgery and other things. Not to say that our people were doing this in a malevolent way, but anyway, I'm just making the correlation right here with the modern day. Christianity adopted October 31 as a holiday in the 11th century as part of efforts to reframe pagan celebrations as its own. So they had to lure our people into this, right? Indeed, the name Halloween derives from All Hallows' Eve, or the day before All Saints' Day, November 1st. But many of the folkloristic aspects of Samhain were incorporated and passed on, costumes included. In medieval England and Ireland, people would dress up in outfits symbolizing the souls of the dead, going from house to house to gather treats or spice-filled soul cakes on their behalf, a Christian custom known as souling. And these little cakes, I've made these before. They're pretty tasty. They're kind of like in between a scone And a cookie, it's kind of like a flat little biscuit type of thing, not too sweet. And it typically has currants, those little dried fruits that are like smaller raisins and a little on the tart side. I remember like a couple of years ago, I was like very into like the ancient aspects of Halloween and Samhain. I made this whole traditional feast with the soul cakes. And I think I made like these really nice pork chops. It was a great feast. From the late 15th century, people started wearing spooky outfits to personify winter spirits or demons and would recite verses, songs, and folk plays in exchange for food, a practice known as mumming. And here's a bit about the American influence of Halloween. As the first wave of Irish and Scottish became arriving in the U.S. in the 18th century, Halloween superstitions, traditions, and costumes migrated with them. So we can thank some of our early ancestors who came over from across the pond to America that kind of made the Halloween culture that we now enjoy today. Once Halloween entered American culture, its popularity quickly spread, according to fashion historian and director of New York University's costume program, Nancy Deal. People in rural America really embraced its pagan roots, and the idea of it as a dark occasion centered around death. They wore scary, frightening get-ups, which were made at home and whatever was on hand, sheets, makeup, improvised masks. Anonymity was a big part of the costumes. The whole point of dressing up was to be completely in disguise. And how different is that now when people are like, I'm going as a, you know, a sexy nurse or whatever people are going as. And I've done a lot of these costumes, so I can't really talk badly about that. But it's just such a different position than what Halloween was originally. And of course, many of us growing up, we probably didn't know this. I don't think I knew it. I just always enjoyed dressing up, getting festooned, you know, going door to door and somewhat of the treats and stuff. I mean, I guess it was nice to kind of have a couple of those sweets, even though it was really one of the only times per the year that I really ate that type of stuff. I think I just enjoyed the ritual. I've always liked this time of year. It always had this magical essence to it, but I really feel like I don't really sense it right now. I just don't. By the 1920s and 30s, people were holding annual Halloween masquerades aimed at both adults and children at rented salons or in the family home. Costume preparations began as early as August. Falling right between summer and Christmas, the celebration also seemed to benefit from its timing in the calendar. It was a way to come together before the turning of the season. Marketers played heavy on that as Halloween became more commercialized, and now Halloween has basically become very mercantile. Like really every other holiday, unfortunately, doesn't mean that you have to have that be a damper on your celebration. You can celebrate any holiday however you see fit. Those same decades also saw the emergence of costumes influenced by pop culture alongside the first major costume manufacturing companies. The J. Halpern Company, better known as Halco of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, began licensing images of fictional characters like Popeye, Olive Oil, Little Orphan Annie, and Mickey Mouse around this time. People also became fascinated with impersonating characters at the fringe of society, adding that pirates and gypsies and even homeless people became common outfit choices. Continuing the tradition of old practices like souling and mumming, Halloween pranks became a common phenomenon in North America, sometimes to the point of vandalism and rioting. By the mid-1940s, the press had dubbed the night's anarchy, or its broken fences and smashed windows, the Halloween problem. And costumes may have partly enabled that behavior. And I know throughout the years I've been privy or aware of to some Halloween tomfoolery, and even throughout the years around where I'm from, they've even outlawed certain things because people just were getting too rowdy. Oftentimes a lot of this behavior was, you know, fueled by alcohol and stuff like that, you know, setting fires and stuff like that. But this is a time of year that I guess has a bit of a mischievous aspect to it. In an effort to discourage the criminal damage, locals and national officials attempted to recast the holiday and dressing up for it as an activity for younger children. The Chicago City Council even voted in 1942 to abolish Halloween and establish Conservation Day on October 31st instead. Interesting. Throughout its history, Halloween has gone through changes of ownership. Its original connection to death became more and more tenuous, which made space for altogether different kinds of costumes. After White War II or World War II, as TV brought pop culture, the Talmud Vision brought pop culture into the family home, American costumes increasingly took after superheroes, comic characters, and entertainment figures. They also became increasingly store-bought. By 1960, Ben Cooper, a manufacturing company that helped turn Halloween into a pop phenomenon, owned 70 to 80% of the Halloween costume market. And just a little bit more here in this article. It was around that time that adults started dressing up for Halloween again. Like the kids' costumes, their approach was often fun more than frightening, and would eventually be just as inspired by Star Wars or Indiana Jones by demons or ghouls. Genuinely speaking, the 60s marked a shift in the way we dress up for Halloween. Grown-ups in particular started ditching masks and full-on coverage, opting to show their faces. Costumes became a way to play a lighter, special version of oneself. But there was still a place for the scary outfits, encouraged by a slew of splatter horror films that started emerging in the 70s and 80s, from John Carpenter's Halloween to Wes Craven's A Nightmare on Elm Street. These decades also saw gay communities across the states adopt the holidays as an occasion to wear outrageous outfits and hold parades, contributing to a boom in Halloween parties and the popularization of provocative costumes that in recent decades have oftentimes leaned towards the overtly sexy and campy. And yeah, especially if you've ever been on Halloween in New York City, you will definitely see a lot of those costumes. I've seen some people before who look like they have had left their pants at home, and I think they actually had. Halloween costumes have gone from disguises to full-on exhibitionist. Today, it's one big capitalist celebration, oy vey, completely detached from any vestige of Christianity or paganism and more centered around expressing people's fantasies, which also explains its success globally. I think they're certainly become more reflective of the times we live in, but there are also fewer people making their own outfits now and a lot less personal creativity going into what you wear. Yeah, it seems like most people just buy a costume in a bag and that's it. I pretty much grew up with us making costumes ourselves, which I think is a lot more fun. Or even if you buy a couple of things at the store, you can still put together like more of a unique look as opposed to just buying a costume in a bag, which I've done, of course, before. Probably all of us have. And I always kind of veered towards more of a costume that was, I guess, kind of like fantasy or storybook or something like that. Like I've been Alice in Wonderland. Oops, sorry about that. I've been everyone from Alice in Wonderland to Little Red Riding Hood. I was Alex DeLarge one year, you know, from Clockwork Orange. So I've been Halloween costumes of, you know, I don't consider that to be transsexualism to dress up like a guy. I don't really care. It's Halloween, whatever. And I like that movie, so I really don't care. But yeah, I've been many different interesting costumes, most of the time being fantasy and things like that. Okay, so that was that little article about Halloween. Pretty interesting stuff right there. I always like to hear about the history of stuff and find out from that perspective of things. Let's see if I have anything else in regards to Halloween. Let me just see. Okay, looks like my screen on my computer is still frozen where it was, but let me just take a very petite gander at the chat on my mobile. Okay. See, it says non-whites shouldn't celebrate Halloween because it's cultural appropriation. Just like they're always trying to howl at us that we're guilty of that. I just saw that Snake Eyes made that comment. I mean, for me, I mean, I don't really mind if anyone else celebrates Halloween, you know, if it's non-whites, but it's almost like we kind of should toss that back in their face because like they're always trying to say for us like, oh, you're culturally appropriating. Like I've even seen like really mind-boggling memes where they're saying that hoop earrings are cultural appropriation, but I believe it was the Romans that first wore hoop earrings. It wasn't, you know, some blacks in the early 80s in a hip-hop video. So yeah, they can take that and do what they want with it. So that was that little Halloween article right there. And I think I have another Halloween article. Let's take a gander at this. Oh, this one's just about the ranking of candy. I don't really give a shit about the ranking of candy. Well, in case anyone is interested what the top ranking candy is, fun-sized candy, Reese's Peanut Butter Cup is the top one that people, I guess, like, or they get out there. That's in this whole thing of 19 candies. That is number one, Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, in case anyone's interested in that. And I think a peanut butter cup is rather tasty, albeit I don't eat Reese's anymore because there's a lot of crud in that brand. So if I was in the mood and I was fixing for a peanut butter cup, I would just get one of the brand Justin's. That's pretty much what I like if I was going to have it. But I don't eat too much of that stuff anymore these days. But if I was going to have it, I would have something like that. Or what's the other brand that's good? Unreal? That's the other one. Yeah, so if I was going to have something like that, and that's the thing. There are better brands out now. I just don't know if a lot of people are giving those out for trick-or-treating. And I saw a whole bunch of crud about how to safely trick-or-treat and how to just put the candy thing outside your house as opposed to actually opening up the door and giving the treats to youngsters. I mean, oftentimes when kids come across a thing of candy outside the house that says take one, oftentimes they take a lot more than one. So I don't really know how that's gonna work, if people are gonna be giving it out or not. Whole year just seems like it's a bit on hold. I remember back 8 years ago when what was that? Hurricane Sandy. We had an awful hurricane here back 8 years ago, and it happened like right around like late October, and it lasted 5 days. We were out power. It was really very, very destructive to Oy Vey Island. And that year, it kind of felt like Halloween was canceled, if you will. I'm just seeing right here that the War of the Worlds broadcast that Orson Welles gave, which was that radio host, that was today, back in 1938. I wonder what was behind all that. I really don't know too much about that. Of course, I'm familiar with Orson Welles and familiar with that War of the Worlds hoax, but that could have been like one of the original kind of like media hoaxes, if you will. Of course, back then in 1938, radio was a medium that I guess a lot of people had more before, what, like the 50s, most people didn't have like a TV inside their house, the electric Jew. That's a good thing to have an electric Jew inside your house. It's a really bad thing. But yeah, that would be an interesting thing to maybe talk about in a broadcast, the War of the Worlds hoax. And that caused a mass panic for people. I've heard from relatives like that was like a really wild time, supposedly. Oh, now my computer has decided to freeze. This sucks. I just clicked out too many windows because I wanted to share some more Halloween stories, but now I have to wait until the computer unfreezes. Maybe I can find another article somewhere else while this unfreezes. Let's see. I'll go to my phone. My phone's not frozen, so I can use that. All right, here we go. Ah, okay. So now it's working. This is just an article of celebrity costumes. Could care less about celebrities. Never really cared about celebrities. They're just slaves of the Jews, essentially. That's all a celebrity is. That is it. All right, this is a New York Times article. They're not going to allow me to look at it because I don't pay for their stuff. This is an article about the history of candy corn. Not that I really care about that. You know, I've actually never had a piece of candy corn. That kind of sounds like maybe I'm lying, but it's the truth. I've never had a piece of candy corn. I like the way it looks, but I'm not going to eat it. Okay, some of these articles are just like pop culture crap. I really don't care about this. Let's see. Gosh, the computer's slow. I think I have to do a cleaning of this. Oh, this is a stupid story, but I think it's probably worth talking about. This is so ridiculous. This is almost like trolling. It's so bad. But anyway, the Satanic Temple awards 4 students with its Devil's Advocates worship. What a load of shit. And of course, this is Jewish Satanism. This is not spiritual Satanism that, you know, of our people or, you know, any other, for lack of a better word, Gentile race. Let's look at what crap they're promoting. The Satanic Temple awarded 4 high school graduates the Devil's Advocate Scholarship, which includes $666 to assist them with their future plans and a trophy. Okay. According to press release, in order to be considered for the scholarship, the students had to answer one of 2 prompts. What initiatives have you undertaken that are consistent with the Satanic Temple's tenets or mission? Or please discuss and describe in any details any one of the teachers who crushed your spirit, undermined your self-confidence, and made you hate every minute you were forced to be in school. The students could address one prompt using a creative medium, including essay, poem, painting, and short film. Really weird. This just seems like it's press to kind of promote, you know, Jewish Satanism next to Halloween. Pretty stupid. This was just in an email where I found those other Halloween stories, but ridiculous. There's nothing satanic about this Satanic Temple. This is Talmudic. That's it. And this is one of the oldest tricks in the book for them to invert and put all of their unsavory doings and transfer them onto us. And finally, people are waking up to that. I've noticed that on Twitter, that there are quite a few people who are aware of that psyop, the psyop of Jewish Satanism pretending to be something and it's not, and they're becoming aware that spiritual Satanism is a, you know, a pagan belief. So I'm happy to see that people are becoming aware of things like this, as opposed to just being stuck in that ridiculous Abrahamic dialectic, which really has to go. It's so stale. It's so tired. All right. What else do I have for this broadcast? Just a couple of things more for this Friday spooktacular broadcast. Let's see. I had something really good that I wanted to share. Okay. Here we go. All right. So here is something that I found over at Nourishing Traditions, which is a website that's ran by Sally Fallon Morell, who of course is associated with the Weston A. Price Foundation. And this was an article that has to do with the state of Illinois and how they are poisoning and starving their prisoners. We shouldn't be surprised, but they are poisoning people in the Illinois prison system with a disgusting, toxic diet, and it goes into soy and how bad soy is. Just wanted to mention a little bit of this here. I'm sure this is happening in other prisons across America. This is probably happening in schools, hospitals, anywhere that's, you know, institutionalized food. State of Illinois is poisoning and starving prisoners. As many of you know, the problem of toxic soy ingredients in prison diets has concerned the Weston A. Price Foundation for many years. It began in 2003 in the Illinois prisons when Blagojevich, could be an Oyve, became governor. He repaid his political debts to Archer Daniel Midlands by eliminating meat from the prison diet and replacing it with soy. Soy nuggets, soy patties, soy sausage, even soy flour in the baked goods. Since the internet search for soy dangers immediately brings up the Weston A. Price Foundation, we soon began receiving desperate pleas for help from Illinois prisoners. And one of the things that's interesting about this magazine, the Weston A. Price Foundation magazine, as well as a now defunct magazine called the East-West Journal, both of these magazines have had a prison subscription, where people who are incarcerated can actually get this type of information and communicate with writing in letters and stuff like that with the magazines. This led to a lawsuit by 6 prisoners, supported by the Weston A. Price Foundation, in which we asked for an injunction against soy in Illinois prison food. This led the lead plaintiff was Larry Harris, who had a severe reaction to the dietary soy, so much so that he was able to get a doctor's prescription for a no-soy diet. The prison did honor this, even if it meant that meals sometimes consisted of one hard-boiled egg or a cup of beans. It's miserable. Unfortunately, we lost the lawsuit, and the prison promptly punished Larry by restricting his no-soy diet, or rescinding, rather. He and most other prisoners survived by purchasing commissionary food with money that friends and family sent to them, often a difficult sacrifice for the families involved. We thought we had lost the battle but won the war when the Illinois Department of Corrections stopped serving soy on January 1 of last year. The men were getting meat again. Decent, though hearty gourmet fare, which satisfied the court rulings, stipulating the prisoners should receive life-sustaining food. Unfortunately, the victory has been short-lived. With Oyid AI, the soy has returned. This is just one of the ramifications of Oyid AI. The state website now openly admits they put 100 grams of soy protein or soy in the prison diet each day, even though the FDA recommends eating no more than 25 grams a day. A typical day includes 2 hard-boiled eggs and 4 ounces of oatmeal for breakfast, soy lunch meat and cheese sandwich for lunch, and a soy goulash for supper, or cold cereal for breakfast, and soy Polish sausage for lunch, and a soy taco for supper. Soy ingredients at this level constitute a poison, invariably leading to severe health problems, including thyroid dis-ease, endocrine disruption, and digestive disorders. This move would not be so bad if the men can purchase food in the commissionary. Unfortunately, because of Oyid AI, the men have been on, quote, lockdown for over 200 days. This means they are locked into their cell. All their meals are brought to them with restricted access to the shower, the phone, and exercise, and worst of all, restricted access to the commissionary. Harris reports that they can now shop at the commissionary only one day per month and are restricted to $75 worth of food per shop, enough to sustain a prisoner for about a week. He reports, this is the person who got sick from the soy. I choose to starve each day versus getting sick. Soy causes bleeding out of my bowels, and each time I use the toilet, severe bleeding hemorrhoids, skin rash on my shoulders, neck, and chest, trouble breathing and sleeping, and exacerbated thyroid symptoms. Starving does not hurt as bad. So far, he has lost 26 pounds. This is miserable what they're doing to people. The commissionary restrictions are especially troubling because commissionary sales are a big source of income for the state of Illinois, generating $34 million in revenue yearly when the prisoners shop each week without restrictions. Normally, they are allowed to spend $150 per week at the commissionary, which is where they purchase only food, but soap and cleaning supplies, laundry detergent, pens and paper, none of which the prison supplies. That is $34 million in taxpayer money freed up to repair bridges, build roads, support schools and do good, and to pay for better prison food. Meanwhile, the staff, who now work only sporadically, and the commissionary still receives $60,000 per year in base pay, and most generate $100,000 per year with overtime. The Department of Corrections has a very strict rule about the commissionary. A grade, where you can shop once a week with no limit, is for prisoners with good behavior. If you get a ticket for a rule violation, you are demoted to B, which allows a prisoner to shop once a month with a $30 limit. Grade C allows you to shop once a month for cosmetics only, like soap and shampoo, and writing supplies, and again, a $30 limit. Grade B and C also have restrictions on shower use, phone call, and yard time. Prisoners are expected to obey the rules, but not the prison staff. Why is there a limit, says Harris. No one has supplied this answer. None of the prisoners is sick, and while a small number of staff is reported sick, the prisoners have no contact with them. How do you rehab a prisoner when he follows the rules but is denied the rights he has coming to him regarding food and supplies? The warden does not move prison workers who have contact with sick staff to the quarantine house, but instead locks down the whole prison with no logic or rationale. 5 prisoners have filed a lawsuit regarding the soy, but this will take time, and meanwhile, everyone is sick and starving. And that is the end of this article right here. They give some contact information if people would like to contact a, someone in Illinois, like a governor or an attorney general. in regards to what is going on here. What a sickening story. We can't be surprised at what the OIVs do. I mean, they're known for literally starving people. Think of all the genocides of yesteryear. So you can't be surprised that they would be, you know, starving people in just one prison here in America. It's probably way more than I'm even aware of. But I just wanted to share that article. I had received an email of this. And of course, soy can show up in many different forms. And I've said before in other broadcasts, if someone's taking in like a small amount of fermented soy, I don't necessarily think that's going to be problematic for most people. If someone's got a thyroid issue, maybe that would be different. And of course, I'm talking about, you know, soy sauce, like traditionally brewed soy sauce, not the crap you get at like the restaurants and stuff. That stuff is toxic. It's actually a test you can supposedly do where you fill like a shot glass up with water and then you drop in a drop of soy sauce. And depending on how the soy sauce kind of like dissipates, you can tell if it's chemically fermented or if it's like old school, like Japanese fermented. But growing up, I definitely ate a little bit more soy than I do nowadays. And now for the most part, I just keep it at soy sauce, sometimes a bit of miso, and I do have some natto in the fridge, which is a really kind of an acquired taste, I guess you'd say. It's fermented soybeans. It kind of has a nutty taste. Some might say it tastes like a sweat sock or something like that, so not exceedingly appetizing, but you might have to really be a food detective to find out if soy is in your food. This would include, you know, checking the label and things like that. And it goes by many different names that you might not even be familiar. Like, for example, if you see hydrolyzed vegetable protein on a label, that could very well be soy. That could also be MSG or MSG. What else could possibly have soy in it? Let's see. Natural flavoring, that's something else. Artificial flavoring, hydrolyzed plant protein. These are all kind of like the crypto names it goes by. Even broths, like vegetable broths and vegetable starches and gums, these could all have soy in them too. So it's definitely something that you might want to look into if you're serious about getting your health optimized. Definitely something that you might want to look into. Yeah, let's see where else. Anything else I can mention in regards to soy. MSG, of course, I've done a couple of shows on that. And also with meat, you want to make sure that you're getting meat that isn't eating this stuff. Like if the meat that you're buying is feeding on soy, feeding on glyphosate-laden corn or wheat, then that's all going to translate into going into you. So always try to do the best you can with whatever your budget is. But if you want to focus on getting very good meat, one of the most affordable ways to buy good meat is to buy like ground grass-fed beef. That's typically like the cheapest cut is ground meat. And you can do a lot with ground meat, way more than just burgers and meatloaf. You can do tacos. You can do like a bolognese sauce. You can do meatballs. So if you want to eat really good food, you might have to maybe eat a cheaper cut and just learn how to cook it in a way that you like, as opposed to like, let's say, buying a steak that's, you know, was feeding on soy and corn and all this, you know, gross stuff that's not good for you, not good for your digestion, not good for your hormones, not good for anything, not good for the animal, not good for the environment, and not good for you. So let's take a wee gander at the chat just to see if I missed anything, because I can't refresh on my on my homepage on my computer. So let's see. Okay, looks like it's the same. That's my echo right there. So let's see if I have anything else that I want to share for this broadcast. It looks like I'm kind of nearing towards the end of what I have to say. I've been going for an hour and a half. Let's see if I have anything else for today on this broadcast. I think that is pretty much it that I have to say for today. Let me just double check if anything else that I left out, any type of Halloween links or any type of Halloween information. Oh, I think we are at the end. Let me see, actually. There was one more thing I wanted to mention, actually. Let me take a gander at that. just before we close out the broadcast. Gosh, the computer is slow. Okay, let me try to go on my computer, use my phone again to see if I can get to this. Oh, now it's working. Okay. All right, well, there was something else in regards to Oyid AI. Fiddlesticks. This is so slow. You know, I'm just going to use my application on my phone. Here we go. Okay, just a moment. My computer's a bit sleepy. All right, here we go. So this is something that Liv, who runs whitedate.net, had sent to me. And it's something that has to do with this guy. I think it's a German guy who's actually doing this scam. And this video, she sent me a link for this video, but the video was not allowed. I went to click on it, of course, on YouTube, and lo and behold, it had been taken down. The guy's name is Dr. Reiner Fuhlmich. I don't know if this is an Oy Vey or not, but this guy seems to be running a scam. And of course, there are always going to be people during a crisis like Oyid AI that are pretending to kind of be on our side, and they're not. So here's this guy, Dr. Reiner Fuhlmich. I think he's a German doctor. Doesn't appear to be an Oy Vey. I'm looking at him right here. Is he an Oy Vey? Maybe he is. I don't know. Sometimes you just can't tell. Let's type it in. Let's find out. Is he an Oy Vey? Let's see. It's hard to say if he is. I mean, Reiner is a Jewish last name. If it's, Karl Reiner or Rob Reiner, those guys are Oy Veys. So this guy is supposedly outlying the Oyid crimes against humanity. So he's been a lawyer in Germany and California for over two decades. He's also one of the four members of the German Corona Investigative Committee. And he is describing how there is no legal doubt about the possibility of class action suit against those responsible for the lockdowns. So that's what he is stating, wanting to do a class action suit. And then this is what Liv wrote to me. She's like, have you watched this Fuhlmich video? His YouTube channel, Untouched, after posting this, invites me to suspect that he is controlled opposition, trying to channel the rage and despair of thousands of victims in a class action, which costs, I think, 80,000 euro per person. I'm not sure what that is in America. Let's just get the breakdown of that so we know what it is. Looks to be about $931. So he's basically looking to scam about $1,000 from a person. That's quite a lot of money, especially in these times. So he's looking to get that much money for a class action suit that might let some heads roll but leave the real perpetrators untouched. Many alarm flags, such as calling the system fascist, which we see all the time, all that as opposed to calling it, communist or corporatocracy or techno-Talmudicism. Building on a whistleblower from the German Green Party and letting the politicians already off the hook as duped and naive believers of the false, quote, experts. So that all sounds pretty suspicious to me. This could be a way just to channel the angst that a lot of people have towards the real perpetrator into something else, and also as an attempt to reinstate or reinstall trust in the legal system, kind of like what they're doing now with voting. They want us to have our faith back in the system in some way, shape, or form, whether it be the legal system, whether it be the medical system, whether it be the system of voting. So this sounds to me from the small amount that I know, it sounds to me like this is playing on people's emotions. It says that with this 800 that they get a symbolic compensation by keeping up the facade of the legal system, and then all the aggression doesn't go to the real perpetrators. Like, again, kind of like a proxy thing, right? Never getting to the root of who's causing the problem, taking advantage of people when they're confused and angry and vulnerable, miserable, right? Miserable. There's a lot of people in this whole Oyed AI scam that to me look like they're trying to be a good guy and trying to have a voice for people who feel, you know, diminished and compromised and screwed over from all of this. But it doesn't really seem like they really have good motives, right? And we're seeing a lot of this. Oftentimes we'll see it with people talking about how bad vaccination is, how awful it is, how we're not going to take it. And then it's all coming to you within the confines of the germ theory. So that's controlled opposition. It just seems like a scam. It's just that sometimes people can't see through these nuances. Like, I know when I'm speaking to people who are kind of, you know, not too familiar with the stuff that, you know, listeners of this network would really, really know, they're just kind of just flabbergasted and very much confused by all of these things. But sometimes just because something looks good on the surface doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good thing. So from what I can tell, it seems like this guy is looking to scam people, to take into consideration if people are confused and annoyed, and to scam them. And that's the easiest and the best time, well, not best, worst, to scam somebody. Horrible. So many things out of this Oyed AI have happened. I think one time I was seeing something on YouTube a couple of weeks ago saying how this really has brought out the best and the worst in people, right? So people who it brought the best out in, it was really their time to share with other people and to make people aware of just, you know, a lot of just the atrocities. And then the people who were scamming and doing all this sleazy stuff, it really brought out the worst in those people. It made them even more scummy and more sleazy. So I think that is all I have for today's broadcast. I think I've exhausted everything that I wanted to say, kind of in just a little bit of a, I guess it was kind of like my own little Halloween broadcast to an extent, and talked a bit about some of the Oyed AI news or juice happening in the world. Let me just give one more gander to the chat. Okay. Didn't see anything in there. So, all right. So I think I will close it out right now. I thank everyone for listening live in the chat, to Josh, to OG Snake Eyes, to Crazy Devil. Thank you guys for listening live. I hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I hope everyone listening has a good Halloween or Samhain, whatever you're going to do. It could be anything. If you're just going to hang out and think about ancestors, maybe dress up in a costume, eat some festive food, whatever you're doing, I hope you have a good time doing it. So thank you again for listening to this broadcast with me, your host, Tabitha, over at the American National Radio Network. Of course, be sure to catch all the broadcasts over here at our network. Wishing everyone a great day and an amazing Halloween and Samhain weekend. Sat Nam. Goodbye, everybody.